Welcome to the Seattle Public Library's podcasts of author readings and library events, a series of readings, performances, lectures, and discussions. Library podcasts are brought to you by the Seattle Public Library and Foundation. To learn more about our programs and podcasts, visit our website at www.spl.org. To learn how you can help the Library Foundation support the Seattle Public Library, go to foundation.spl.org. I'm Chris Higashi, Program Manager of the Washington Center for the Book at the Seattle Public Library. Welcome to tonight's event with Rebecca Miller. We're thrilled to welcome you to Seattle. So first, we thank Elliott Bay Book Company for inviting us to co-present this evening, the Seattle Times for generous promotional support for library programs, our author series sponsor, Gary Kunis. And finally, this event is supported by the Seattle Public Library Foundation. So now here's Karen Maeda Allman from Elliott Bay Book Company to introduce our special guest. Thank you.
Good evening, and thank you very much again for attending the program this evening when we will be presenting with library novelist, screenwriter, and actress Rebecca Miller. Rebecca Miller is the author of some earlier books, including Personal Velocity, a collection of short stories. She read from this at Elliott Bay a number of years ago, and we still have very fond memories of this. She's also the author of Private Lives of Pippa Lee, which some of you I know are fans of the movie as well as of that novel, and also has written, among her other screenplays, Ballad of Jack and Rosie. And some of these have been award winners, and there certainly have been audience favorites. This latest novel is, I think, a real departure for her, it seems. It's in part a historical novel. It incorporates kind of three strands of stories. It also incorporates folk tales, some stories from contemporary Hasidic life, lots of research, and some very engaging and unexpected sorts of characters. And so I think that'll be really wonderful to hear her speak about this novel a bit this evening and tell us how it came about. So with that, please join me in welcoming Rebecca Miller.
Hello. Thank you for coming. It's amazing to be in this this extraordinary building. It's so heartening to see such a beautiful new edifice just for books and reading. It makes one feel there's a future after all. I won't talk too much about the book and the genesis of the book before I read you a little bit of the book, because I feel that it would maybe spoil it, and maybe it's better to read a little and a bit, and then And then we can talk about it, if that's okay. Just so you know, this book was meant to be, the way I constructed it was in the shape of a challah bread, which is a braided bread with three strands. So it's a kind of braided structure, and with one strand being in the 18th century and the other two being contemporary. So when you actually read the book, you're kind of gliding from one period and one sort of story strand to the next. And when I read it to you, obviously I'm going to have to give you a little bit of insight of what you would know in order to jump into that strand, because I can't read you the whole thing tonight. So I'm just going to read the beginning, a bit of the beginning of the book. I, the being in question, having spent nearly 300 years lost as a pomegranate pip in a lake of aspic, amnesiac, bodiless, and comatose, a nugget of spirit but nothing else, found myself quickening, gaining form, weight, and finally consciousness. I did not remember dying, so my first thoughts were confused and a little desperate. As the blinding layer of black cloud I was enshrouded in dissipated, I saw the moon, opalescent, crater-pocked, impassive, frighteningly close. Indifferent stars carved up the firmament with their dazzling ancient patterns. there was an echoing sound, like huge air bubbles escaping flatulently from an enormous wide-mouthed bottle underwater in a Turkish bath with a domed roof. But there was also a tearing, a continuous ripping, as if a universe-sized sheet of canvas were being torn asunder. I now know this was the fabric of time. I felt intensely alone and cried out, but my shriek sounded submerged. Instinctively, I beat the wings I didn't know I had and rose. I could fly. Was I dreaming? The black air was surprisingly viscous. My wings outstretched, I let myself descend, circling slowly through the thick stuff, passing through roiling, wispy clouds that felt cool on my skin. I was definitely awake. Could I be an angel? Euphoria and disbelief gathered in me. I reveled at having been chosen against all odds to be part of the heavenly host. I yearned to admire myself, or better, to be admired. I knew I must be very beautiful. I flapped my wings, spreading them wide, banking, making a slow round, wending my way down through the night. Below me, a web of lights like a spume of stars spilled out into a great darkness. As I neared, I saw the blackness churning, cresting. The sea. I was looking down on the earth. But what were all those lights? Descending more rapidly as old Rosy Fingers passed her bright hand over the ocean, washing it with light, I could now make out a crust of houses built up on the twinkling island below like a skin malady. The massive grid of roofs rose to meet me vertiginously. Swirling through the atmosphere, I had no idea where I was, but I knew I'd been gone a long time. Smooth-hipped, humpish carriages gleamed at the doors of the toy-like dwellings. Street lamps spilled pools of steady light on ruled streets as smooth as stretched toffee. It was the future. I knew it. The last tool of illumination I had seen was a porcelain candelabrum beside my bed in Paris in 1773. It was encrusted with light green leaves, tiny pink roses, and cherubim. I stared at the wax dripping down the candles for hours and hours until, at dawn, I died. Sunday, the 7th of February, 1773. I was 31. After that, nothing. And now I was an angel. I imagined myself as a fully formed Christian seraph, a Viking with blonde hair, a beautiful chiseled torso, hairless feet, and eyes the color of whiskey. When I was alive, I was dark-haired, short, slight, with light eyes, strong teeth, and a thick, long sex that I scented and coiled inside my britches daily with great care and pride, an aspect of my physicality which I hoped had been duplicated by the Almighty. But whenever I tried to look down at myself, I could not move my neck, and my arms felt very weak. I assumed this stiffness was due to the long period of being dead. Something amazing had happened to my sight. It was as if the top of my head had been removed and replaced with an enormous eye. I could see jagged purple clouds drifting above me, the streets stretching away at either side, and the houses below. This is how angels see, I marveled. I noticed a gigantic figure stride out of one of the shiny carriages. Trying to focus on him and ignore the rest of the nearly 360-degree view, I descended cautiously, not yet in full command of my wings, afraid that the man might see me, yet half hoping he would. The thought of bringing this titan to his knees with astonishment and awe was attractive to me. I imagined myself as an angel in a painting, my chiton frozen mid-billow as I reached my delicate hands out expressively, the object of my communication falling to the ground with awe and wonder, his eyes rolling up in his head. Yet as I hovered above him, I had an alarming double vision. I saw the man, and I knew him. Now I'm just going to read a little bit of this next chapter, which introduces one of our other characters. reliable true Leslie Senza Tamore stood on his square of new-mown grass at the cusp of dawn, planted his feet far apart, leaned back, and aimed a glistening arc of piss straight over the fading moon. The heavenly body glowed, lassoed by his steaming ribbon, and maybe even claimed by a man who, at 44, had every reason to be content. Unlike most of the residents of this tree-lined Long Island street, Leslie owned his house outright, a split-level ranch-style home presently stuffed with three sleeping children, one au pair, a splendid wife, two cats, a daughter-in-law, and an aging cocker spaniel. A vintage motorboat, totem of the family's well-earned leisure, gleamed beneath a tarp. Four cars of varying sizes and prices, from his wife's toy-strewn Ford Explorer to his stepson's dusty Slovakian compact, were evidence of busy, work-filled lives. A smaller house to one side was also Leslie's and contained his hard-drinking in-laws, the most voluble of a spate of dependents that Leslie had welcomed onto his back throughout his adult life like a cheerful Sisyphus. Leslie was a natural hero and had been ever since the day he had rescued the kittens from under the Bobbick's roof when he was 13 years old back in 1981, which is a story I can't read to you right now because that's way too long. Okay. So now comes the moment. Not a good moment for Jacob. Okay. Now, what happens is Jacob realizes he's a very small angel because he can fit on a leaf. And he attaches himself to Leslie as a kind of host. Leslie sends it to Maury, the volunteer fireman. And he crawls under his collar, and he goes with him on his errands for the day. And one of the things that Leslie does is he goes to visit a man that he rescued from a fire the night before because he actually knew this man. He's somebody he grew up near in his neighborhood. And Jacob, who is somewhat discouraged by the general goodness of Leslie Senza Tamore, and Jacob is a little alarmed by very good people. So he goes and he starts to float around the hospital. And, of course, everything's very unfamiliar to him since he's from the 18th century. And he kind of finds himself inside a stream of warm air, which he follows into another hospital room, curious and trying to kind of entertain himself while Leslie talks to this old man. So here, this is what happens. I flew high, skimming the rough panels in the ceiling, and looked down at two narrow beds separated by a cloth curtain. The shades were drawn. The room was fairly dark. Two young women were lying on two beds. One was asleep. Her body lay jagged as if broken under the thin blanket. Her hand swiped her face as she slept. I floated down and had a look at her, hovering so close that I could see her eyeballs scanning beneath the lids as she dreamed. Her skin was slick. Her hair, unwashed, clung to her forehead. I was reminded of prison. The women had been so shockingly unkempt there. Hair frayed and dull, skin sallow, lips cracked. It made me realize how important a woman's toilette was to her appearance. In a state of nature, most women are hideous, even the beauties. I was so close to this one, I could smell her metallic breath. Still giddy with my ability to fly, I sucked up my abdomen, pumped my wings a couple of times, and banked to the right, over the top of the curtain, toward the other girl's bed. This one was awake, looking up at a luminous box clamped to the ceiling with a metal device. I flew up to the box and looked inside it. Within, tiny figures moved out round in a most lifelike way. One of them was a fair-haired woman. She removed a red wrap to reveal a slender torso barely covered in a chemise. I tried to fly into that luminous world, but was repelled by a wall of warm glass. Slightly stunned by the collision, I looped up to the top of the box and perched at the edge, feeling its heat and vibrations as I gazed down at the girl in the bed. She was propped up on several pillows, staring upward with an expression of amazed fascination. Her intent face, bathed in the cerulean glow of the box, was captivating. Very large onyx eyes, padded lips drifting open to reveal an insolent gap between strong front teeth. Her long, thick hair was dark, almost navy in the half-light. Her flimsy green gown hung open, and I glimpsed a patch of naked skin. Habitually curious about all breasts, I dove down to get a better look and hung in the air, wings beating, peering into the folds of the gown. I was just able to make out the curve of a plump, high tit. Boldly, I landed on the nipple. Tiny as I was, I seemed to be crawling up the face of a cratered red mountain. Strange, I thought, that I was unable to stand upright. Instinctively, I flicked out my tongue to glance the ridged mound of rose-colored flesh beneath me. I tasted salt and smelled the aroma of young, unwashed flesh, a pleasant, milky bouquet with a faint undertone of sweat. Without warning, I felt a solid wall sweeping my body over the fleshy hill. I rolled over several times and was propelled into the air, my wings beating frantically to keep me up. A hand rose up huge before me, still in the act of brushing me off. She had felt me. I had substance. That was good. Invisible, but extant. I floated in the air, enjoying the weightlessness, the giddy feeling of power that flight brought to me. I had always hated the heaviness of life. Senseless obligation, the strictures of time, I had made my life an affront to these killjoys. True, I had only had 13 years of freedom, but better to die beautiful with a bacchanal taking place downstairs where certain people are actually missing your presence than in unlusted after old age, your day a round of senseless tasks, no pleasure in sight. Pleasure, to manifest myself. Flying in neat circles in the light of the luminous box, I was enlivened by my memories. What a joyous time a handsome young angel could have with this lush girl as that sickly ragdoll snored behind the curtain. I felt my sex so keenly, it was a torture not to be able to touch it, to reassure myself it was still there. But my withered angel arms were too short. I could only wave them miserably. What if, as an angel, I had no sex, only desire? That would be a tailored hell. I had to know what I was. I landed on a smooth, cool, vertical plane. I am so light, I thought. I can grasp a wall. I rested there for a moment, gathering my thoughts. Perhaps this was only a phase of being. Corporeal manifestation might come in time. I looked at the smooth, unrippled surface before me. Reflected in it was the luminous box with its tantalizing, unreachable images. I was standing on a mirror. I stared into it, yearning to see an image of myself. But where my form should have been, all was dark. Was I casting a shadow? Filled with hope, I took off, my wings propelling me back slightly before I rose, circling the mirror and looking into it. All I could see was the luminous box, the girl's profile, the ceiling with its gray square tiles, and a fly zigzagging back and forth through the air. I was still invisible. Oh, I yearned to see myself. I looked into mirrors compulsively when I was alive. I never passed one without checking the state of my beauty. And I passed many lustful moments with others and alone, staring at my own reflection in ornate mirrors belonging to aristocrats or the cracked, stippled rounds hanging in brothels. Now, with no reflection to confirm my existence, I felt claustrophobic, suffocated, erased. Desperate, I beat my wings and rose up. Flight soothed me. The fly in the mirror rose. I let myself sink a bit. So did the fly. I landed on the mirror and watched the glass go dark, felt the cool of it on my feet. I was a fly. I wept with rage and helplessness. So, that's that part. How are we doing? Should I read a little bit more? Okay. So, I can't decide if I should read the part about being in the Shabbos, in the contemporary part or the 18th century part? What? 18th century, okay. All right, so Jacob is a peddler. He carries all his things in a box, what they called a Jew's box, actually, on his front, so it's around his neck, and it's a big box, wooden box, that has many drawers. Everything from watch fobs to knives, etc. He one day is approached by a housekeeper of a great house, of an aristocrat, and he comes in. He's asked to come inside this house, and the man of the house, the aristocrat, the Comte de Villard, invites him to be his second valet. He says, "You're a Jew, right?" He affirms he's a Jew first, and he says, "I would like you to be my second valet." And he sort of freaks him out, really. And Jacob leaves, and goes back to his normal life. So that's what you need to know so far. Having fled the great house of the Comte de Villard and his bizarre offer of employment, I had returned gratefully to the routine of my days. My mother woke me tenderly at 5 o'clock each morning, bringing a basin of water to my bed. I performed my ablutions, washing my hands of the unclean spirits that might have settled on my body during the night, and said my morning prayer of thanks. I put on my tzitzit, a fringed protective garment like a prayer shawl with a slit cut in the middle for the head to go through. Over this, I wore what I hoped was a French-looking chemise, a red vest with silver buttons, and a black coat. I hid my yarmulke beneath a black felt three-cornered hat. I scurried to morning prayer with my brother and my father at one of several places of worship set up in various houses in our section of Paris. We did not have a synagogue. Then my father and I yoked up our peddler's boxes and set off to make a little money, calling out hoarsely, "Watch fobs, knives, snuff boxes," etc. The streets of Paris were cacophonous with the cries of peddlers selling everything from baked apples to firewood to water pumped from the Seine. Each peddler had his or her own cry, and we milled through the streets, across the bridges, baskets and boxes strapped to us, crying out our wares. My brother Shlomo was exempt from this work. The treasured scholar of the family, he stayed back to study all day. I didn't envy him. In the afternoons, I played skittles with other boys in the courtyard or ran wild through the neighborhood with my gang of friends. I had no inclination to study the holy texts in my free time as I was meant to, nor did I have any great interest in business. I just wanted to enjoy myself as much as possible. My father, a serious, even doleful man, thought I was a ruffian in the making. I'm skipping a little bit. My young life pattered on in its usual way for several months until I got the jolting news that I was to be married. I was 17. My betrothed had been selected for me out of the meager handful of Jewish girls in Paris by the local matchmaker in collusion with my parents. The marriage contract was hammered out through a marriage broker. Hodel Mendel was just 14. As my parents saw it, Hodel was a catch. Her father, Mayor Mendel, was the only ritual slaughterer on the right bank. The ritual slaughterer was an important man in our community. On top of that, the Mendels offered a substantial dowry plus room and board for 3 years. Who could resist? As for me, I was dying to sleep with a woman, and Hodel was not a bad-looking girl. When I saw little Hodel on the evening of our wedding, she was hanging by her elbows between her tall mother and her squat father, being guided through the courtyard of her family building like a blind person. Her face was entirely whited out by an opaque veil that fell to her waist, giving me the curious impression that her head was on backward. I stood with my parents beneath the wedding canopy, trembling in my white coat, waistcoat, and breeches, over which I wore a kittel, a white linen robe, white for mourning to remind me of my own death. Yet in truth, my kittel could have been my own burial shroud, given what my marriage would turn out to be. Hodel looked very small and rigid beside her panther-like black-browed mother, who was maneuvering her toward me with a firm grip. Her little badger of a father had to raise the girl's elbow in order to keep her level. It looked as if they were heaving a draped statue across the courtyard. Hodel seemed to be making no effort to walk. In fact, she was quite stiff. I wondered if her feet were being dragged along the ground beneath her wedding gown. The four candle-bearing matrons walking before this coercive procession lent the ceremony an eerie air of sacrifice. At last, Hodel was beside me, perfectly hidden behind the thick white silk. After my father pronounced the 7 blessings, when Hodel's veil was raised, a corner lifted by each parent, I saw that her eyes were inflamed and swollen from weeping. Her round cheeks had tear tracks on them. Her breath shuddered and caught like that of a tiny child who has been bawling. I crushed the glass beneath my heel with a sudden rush of anger. Okay, so then, my wedding night was a disaster. Though 14, Hodel had the mentality of a small child. Her submission to my clumsy fingers seemed obscenely forced by the unseen hands of our parents and tradition. She whimpered and shrank away from my caresses. Her newly shorn hair, cut after the wedding, as was our tradition, made her look even younger and confused me terribly. I persevered, mumbling encouragements that it would soon be over. All I could think of was the examination our sheets would be submitted to by Madame Mendel in the morning. With no blood, the marriage would not be real and I would not be a man. As it turned out, I had to prick my own finger and wipe it on the sheet in the morning, having given up my entreaties by dawn. My bride had a week of relief after that first night. The blood of my finger was accepted as Hodel's, and so she was unclean for a week, and we had to sleep in separate beds. But on the eighth day, my efforts continued. To be fair, Hodel wanted to become a woman and do her duty, but she was terrified. It took a full month to actually deflower her. Her plump little body seemed to have no natural ingress. I felt I was trying to puncture a thigh or a belly, so resiliently did her flesh resist my poor prick. Night after night, I came to a crisis without actually entering my own wife, her rubbery body repelling me again and again. At last, I convinced her to straddle me, and I impaled her, though my sense of triumph was dulled by her whimpering as I finally burst the dam. I fluctuated between guilt and despair in our first months together as I realized that I had been saddled with a hysteric. Hodel spent most of her time in my presence crying for her mother. The terrible Madame Mendel lived upstairs from us, but she insisted from the first day that we lived on our own as husband and wife, not as her children. A good head taller than her husband and all of but one of her six sons, Madame Mendel had black eyes and swarthy, wind-lashed skin. She had an intimidating, predatory slowness about her. She never rushed, yet she was prone to sudden surges of dislike and irritation and lashed out at her endless progeny with the whip of the tongue in the fastest Yiddish I had ever heard. Having come from a tiny town in Poland when her first few children were young, she still had the mind of a provincial woman. Her superstitions were elaborate and terrifying. A pregnant woman stepping on fingernail clippings meant certain miscarriage. A hair in the milk meant a demon had been in the house. She never entered a room without kissing the mezuzah. She had even gone so far as to avoid giving her children grand names so as not to make the demons jealous. She chose Hodel, Lieb, Scheindel. No Esthers or Abrahams for this canny lady. She never paid anyone a compliment for the same reason. If anyone complimented her, she spat on the floor to ward off the evil eye. When her children were babies, she made tiny tears in their garments. Demons were of a lower order than humans, and they were always jealous of us, she explained. No one should be too beautiful or too lucky. She sensed countless evil spirits and sprites swirling around her, just waiting for her to slip up. Still, I was grateful that she allowed us to eat our evening meal upstairs with her and the rest of the family, as Hodel seemed to be genuinely afraid of boiling water or hot liquid of any kind. So, needless to say, the marriage is not a great success. And he does, in fact, end up working for the Count. And many, many things happen after that. Okay, well, I have some stuff about, I can either just answer some questions and then if you want, I can read you a bit of the contemporary Jewish part, which is sort of an interesting bit, or I can, I bet you, do you have questions to start with? Yes. So how did the process, what was the process of, you know what, it was a really gradual thing and I kind of wrote into the dark initially. Actually, the first image that I had was, I read it here, was Leslie Sensatamore standing on his front lawn having a pee in the, over the fading moon. And sensing that I felt there was, I had a kind of hunch that there was another creature, some little thing up there. Like a little mischievous presence, you know, some sort of spirit presence. Maybe a soul that was stuck between two lives, I didn't know, but it was just an intuition. And then I left it for a while because I had to do some other work. And then I came back and by then Masha had kind of come into my mind as this character and I didn't yet know she was Jewish. And what happened was that I happened to be rowing in a boat in Prospect Park in Brooklyn with a friend of mine and one of my kids. And there was a flock of Hasidic Jews that happened also to be rowing in Prospect Park. And I just got mesmerized, especially by the women. And by, you know, it was the hottest day in August in New York, and they were wearing long sleeves and stockings and skirts and wigs. And I was just so kind of, I was so curious, you know. And it suddenly came to me that Masha, should be an observant Jew. I mean, I didn't make her in the ends Hasidic. I made them, they're Torah Jews, it's the same rules, but there are differences in that they don't speak Yiddish at home and so on. But I mean, I decided to try and penetrate that community in some way, and took quite a lot, you know, then came the whole beginning of the research. But as I started to research all of these, everything about contemporary and folkloric Judaism and as everything I could, I came across some articles that this lady had written, who was a mother of 10 children in Canada. She was a Satmar Jew, and she wrote about her daughter, like her daily life, little funny things, and her daughter had been followed around by a fly all day. And in the article she says, the daughter says, well, maybe it's a soul doing penance. And I said, what? And I thought, is there reincarnation in Judaism? And nobody told me. So then I started researching that, in fact, there is something called Gilgul, which is the return of souls, of Jewish souls, to atone for sins. And some of them can come back as animals in tradition, in folklore tradition and in Kabbalah, in fact. And so then I started to, then I thought, okay, I know who my guy is. So that's sort of how, once I had my triangle, and then there, you know, the 18th century is sort of another story, but that's sort of how the basic thing happened. But it, yeah. Yeah. Other questions? Yeah. Yeah, well, regarding the research of the contemporary Jewish life, I actually kept knocking on every door I could find, like, you know, trying to find someone who knew somebody who knew somebody who knew somebody, and I found somebody, and who introduced me to a family living in Woodmere, Long Island, and I got to stay there a couple of times, and the mother sort of took me under her wing and we became kind of pen pals. And she was very nice. She was very unjudgmental of, I mean, I was very respectful of their way of life. And she was, had a great sense of humor and was sort of open to having me come and stay a little bit. And mostly it was the back and forth writing that, you know, I would ask her a question in a week or, you know, and she would just write back. And that was a big thing. And then I did a lot of reading, you know, a huge amount of reading. I read every book I could find about, you know, by people who had left or by, just by scholars. And then I became really interested in Jewish folklore, and I read as much about Jewish mysticism as I could without, I got kind of lost a little bit. And then I realized that I could probably research this book for, you know, the rest of my life. So I had to control myself and say, you know, I'm a storyteller and not a scholar. And so I took what I really needed. But that's how it happened. It was a friend of a friend who was a composer who was actually from, which means that she observes the laws of family purity and is, in traditional to a degree. And then she knew a family even deeper in that was like really pretty much cut off culturally. And that's how I got there. About the structure, really, it's a question of how I developed the structure. Well, you know what? It was a thing of like working unconsciously to a degree, but then stopping, spending sometimes months researching, coming back, and eventually, the way it happened was it was like islands coming out of the sea, like they were emerging. And at first, I just saw the tips. And then gradually the landmass, I started to see, it started to connect. And as I started to have something that was starting to connect, then I became more, kind of my critical mind got more involved, and I started to really create a plot, which I actually didn't end up following all the way because, of course, the characters take you different places, and especially Leslie has a kind of crisis within it that I didn't expect, and so I had to rework a lot of stuff. But so it was going back and forth. I mean, it took 5 years, the whole thing took. So it was a question of sort of writing up to where I could, and then I would come up against darkness and I couldn't see, and I would have to stop, read, think about it, structure it, and then go back and write again. And it was a kind of, became more linear as, the further in the process I went. If that makes sense. Yes. My father was a writer, and was I encouraged to write, and was I raised in a Jewish home, a traditional Jewish home? I was not raised in a traditional Jewish home. So in a way, I was doing, in some ways, the contemporary observant Jewish life was as exotic to me as the 18th century in some ways. I mean, like, I was as unfamiliar with that, with certain things. Was I encouraged to write? Yeah, I was encouraged to write. I always liked to write when I was a kid, and I wrote a lot as an adolescent, but I didn't publish anything for a long time, and I kind of went a different way. I was a painter, and I kind of came, you know, I went through filmmaking and came to writing in a kind of circle, which was better for me because I had more to write about because I had lived a little. Yeah. Do I struggle with distractions, and how do I stay true to myself as an artist? I do struggle with distraction, but I'm also really kind of dogged, and once I have a very strong ability to cut out other things. You know, once I get concentrated on one thing, I can kind of cut out. If I have to concentrate for 2 hours, I can really concentrate for 2 hours, even if other things are going on. And I tend to be quite focused in that way. And I find that it's funny because it's, you know, when I finished writing something, I think, when did I have time to write? Because my days suddenly become so full and I don't remember how it was that I ever, you know, did it, because it doesn't seem like there's any time. But the truth is, if you really have to do it, I think you just find out, you find a way of doing it. It becomes a compulsion and a habit. At this point, you know, I've been doing it for so long that making things, whatever it is that I do, it's like a habit I can't break. It's sort of part of living for me. You know, I get very uncomfortable if I'm not doing it. So I think the key is, it's sort of like exercise, I think. It's like, I'm not a person who has to exercise all the time, but I think there are people like that, and sort of like that. Yeah. What films I made? Well, what happened was, initially I was a painter, and I had a kind of revelation when I was 21 that I wanted to make film. I wanted to make films because I saw a Fellini movie, La Dolce Vita, and I realized that it was the perfect form for me in a way, because I'd love to write and I love to paint, and that it kind of brought those things together. And so then I was like, oh no, I don't know how to make films. And you know, so I went back and I started to study film, and I made a bunch of short films, and in order to finance those films, I acted in a couple of movies through a series of accidents, which I'm not going to go into. I'm not really an actress. I was an actress in that period. And then I wrote a film called Angela, which took me a couple of years to get the money for, and I finally got the money from a private investor, actually. And I made that film. And that film won some awards but made no money in the box office. So then it was very difficult to get money for another film. I wrote a film called The Ballad of Jack and Rose, but I couldn't get money for that film. And as the years went by, I thought, what am I doing? You know, I just want to tell stories. I'm going to teach myself how to write prose. And at first it was very skeletal because I was used to writing screenplays and not prose. And gradually I taught myself to put flesh on the bones, you know. And I had a wonderful teacher, a friend who's a poet, Honor Moore, who became a kind of mentor to me. And then I wrote this collection of short stories called Personal Velocity. And I got an agent through my friend Honor. She sent it to her agent. And then that agent sent it to publishers, and I got a publisher. And then my friend Gary Winnick, who's now dead, but he had this wonderful film company then called Indigent, aptly named because we made the movies for nothing. And he came to me and said, would you be willing to make a film for $250,000? And I said, well, I don't want to give you any of my screenplays. I had this pile of screenplays nobody had made. But I said, we could maybe make one of my stories. And he has the idea of making a triptych out of it. And I wrote the screenplay, made the film. And then that won Sundance. And so suddenly I had a film career again. And then I got to make Jack and Rose, which was a movie that, you know, no one would let me touch. And then after that I wrote, you know, I had the bug of writing. And then I wrote The Private Lives of Pippa Lee. And I was still hungry after I wrote the novel to explore those characters in a different medium, so I made the film, The Private Lives of Pippa Lee. And I've made four films, and then I've written three books, and that's sort of how I found this funny pattern that was just my own way of doing things. sort of an accident. Failure really is the answer of how I... The screenplays? I wrote the screenplays. Yes, I did. I mean, I have to say, you know, I'd be curious to know what it would be like to direct a screenplay of one of my books that I had not written the screenplay of. That would be an interest. I've suddenly become more interested in doing that a little bit to kind of mix things up a little bit. But I always did everything. And that was one of the problems. I mean, not a problem, but what happens is that then it's years and years. Because not only do you have to, you know, write the novel, write the screenplay, make the movie, edit the movie, but then you have to talk about the book and the movie. And that's the part. And, you know, in order to publicize it, you have to speak about it. And by the end of that, it's years, it's a long, long time to be stuck in one story. So, yeah. Can I imagine this as a movie? Well, you know, this is quite big to try and put into a two-hour format. And I think the problem I would have if it was a feature film would be just I would have to leave out so much that I would worry that it would simplify the whole thing. Maybe one day it could be a longer piece, like, you know, a miniseries, something like that. But at this moment, I see it really just as a book, and I'm so enjoying having it be a book that I don't see it as a film right now. Obviously, it would have to be, you know, a lot of special effects, and I'm not sure. I'm not sure if that would be good. Yeah. Well, do you get sick of talking about one story? I think you get sick of it if you've been doing it consecutively for a long, long time. I mean, if it's like months and months and months, you feel like you're repeating yourself. Like right now, I'm excited to talk about this because it just came out on the 5th of March. So, I mean, I'm not tired at all of talking about it. And now that Pippa is in the past, I actually wouldn't be sick of talking about it. But I remember at the end of having, you know, once I got to the end of that process, I felt like I was just repeating myself. I was more just bored with myself than anything else. Yeah. What was the most important lesson that I learned when I was, or what were they, in learning to write prose? I think to be patient and to stop and be sensual, to address the senses. And I think that that was really the most important thing, because how do you make somebody really drink in a scene? There are so many different ways of doing it, and kind of engaging the senses was something that ended up being more and more important to me, and that was what my teacher really taught me. Speaking of which, do we have time to read? I just want to read you one little thing that has to do with engaging the senses, and it also is set in Masha's home. So Jacob has gone home with Masha after the hospital. She's quite ill, with a mysterious illness, and he goes home with her and lives in the Edelman household. Mordecai Edelman is the father. Pearl is the mother. They have 10 children. Miriam is the oldest daughter with several children. And they have kids all the way from 23 to a 10-month-old baby, actually. So it's a large family. And, okay. The shaggy, fur-hatted Mordecai stood up at the tip of his beautifully set table, 21 heads turned in his direction, and chanted the Kiddush, a brimming silver cup of wine in his hand. Once he had finished, he took a careful sip of wine, then poured a few drops, sadly cut with apple juice, into everyone's glass. I realized grimly that I had landed in a family of teetotalers. They all took a gulp of the pathetic concoction. Then Pearl and the girls got up briskly to set out the feast. French roast beef, pistachio-stuffed chicken breasts, salmon roulade, gefilte fish with horseradish, quinoa salad, fruit and lettuce salad, potatoes in mustard sauce, roasted garlic, hummus, baba ganoush, blueberry cobbler. Two of Pearl's sweet loaves of challah were nestled beneath their embroidered crimson velvet coverlet like dew-covered manna. It was paradise. With a shudder of pleasure and surprise, I stepped into a droplet of gravy and tasted the rich, salty fat through the pads in my feet. In a trance of sensory overload, I strolled from one luscious crumb to another, sometimes even flying to a serving dish or to drink from the rim, knowing full well that my hosts were forbidden to kill anything, even flies, on the Sabbath. These people were not even allowed to wash lettuce after Friday sundown, lest they kill the bugs hidden in the leaves. I was completely safe. They shooed me away several times, of course, but nobody dared swat me. Ali Shaya's husband, Yitzhak, a humorist, even quipped, "He's a Jewish fly. He knows we can't kill him today." I laughed at that joke along with the rest of the party. The men sang a hymn with strong voices, rocking their heads, tapping the table with their fingers. While the men sang, the women, forbidden to sing in front of men they were not related to, lowered their eyes and mouthed the words silently. The singing of a woman is akin to nakedness. I remembered that from the old days. Eventually, the ladies let the men keep singing and engaged in conversation. "Mommy, have you ever tried rice kugel?" Miriam asked. "No, but I heard about it. Dr. Cohen told me about it while she was sewing me up for my last cesarean." "What are you talking about?" Pearl said with a laugh. "You know how I always manage to have my babies on a Friday, right? So she's delivered the baby, and she's sewing me up, and she's telling me about this great new recipe for rice kugel she's trying, and she had to leave it half done because I went into labor. I'm lying there trying to act interested with my belly open like somebody's purse." "Miriam," said Pearl, "we're eating." "How many cesareans you had?" asked Suri. "Two, right?" "The last three. I told Dr. Cohen she should just put in a zipper." "You shouldn't do more than three, I thought," said Ali Shaya. "We'll see," said Miriam. The men finished their hymn, unfazed by the women's lack of attention. Masha, meanwhile, was silent. Her stare was inward, intense. Pearl looked over at her several times, but she didn't want to fuss over her too much. The girl worried her so. I decided to try a little something. Flying behind her shoulder, I noticed she was working the paper napkin in her lap, twisting it with her fingers. "Tear it," I said. By the way, we know that Jacob can speak inside of Masha's head. I knew she wasn't allowed to tear on the Sabbath, not even toilet paper. They had to use Kleenex. Her fingers kept working the paper, but she wouldn't rip it. "Tear it," I said, forcing my voice into her head, looping through the air. "Tear, tear, tear." And then, with a calm, intent face, my beloved tore a single layer of the paper napkin under the table, her heart whomping against its boundary like a carpet beater. The thin layer of paper seemed to take a fortnight to rip asunder. Just one steady tear on and on as the men started in on another hymn. Masha, whom I was now watching from the back of Mother Pearl's chair, raised her eyes and watched them sing, all the while secretly tearing the napkin. I tried to listen to her thoughts, but all I got was her voice singing the same haunting song as the men. They were singing Kavakoras, a prayer generally reserved for Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, only occasionally dusted off for more ordinary occasions due to its extreme beauty and holiness. Masha was singing very loud inside her head, watching them, eyebrows raised, her lips mouthing the words. And then, to my astonishment, she began to actually sing. At first, she didn't realize what she was doing. She had forgotten herself. But then she knew. Her voice became clear, strong, defiant. It drowned out the men's voices. One by one, the men stopped singing and stared at her. She sang with all her heart, her pure eyelids shut. The party looked at her, stunned. Dovid, Simki, and the young visitor, Aaron, looked down at their plates, rigid with embarrassment, as though she were performing a striptease. Even I was shocked. When the song ended at last, blood came to Masha's cheeks. She opened her eyes and smiled, embarrassed. Mordecai spoke softly, with disappointment and astonishment. "Masha," he said.
This podcast was presented by the Seattle Public Library and Foundation and made possible by your contributions to the Seattle Public Library Foundation. Thanks for listening.